is Danny, Dave, and Moore.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio.
Now, the opening drive.
Seahawks' first scrimmage was Saturday. A long injury list today, and that includes Bobby Wagner getting a procedure done. What kind of procedure? Well, he's not quite sure, but Bobby Wagner's done it before, and it's something that's worked for him, so I don't think any of us should be all too concerned about it. But I do love the little coy cat-and-mouse games of injury reporting in the preseason when teams are not required to disclose the injuries.
If you were a coach, wouldn't you want to reveal as little as possible?
Yeah.
I mean, I would just be like, if I was a coach, I'd say, well, I'm sorry, that's none of your damn business. That's what I would say. That's what my reply would be.
Does it matter that much in the preseason, though?
Well, I guess so. I mean, it's the one thing that, like, makes people worry the most. But I think, you know, for the way the preseasons are now, like, even the scrimmage, it wasn't a full tackle to the ground, you know, blow people up. So they're just very cautious during that period of time. And I can understand why. You just see how expensive the players are, you know. They're like these high-priced sports cars, man. And if you get a ding in the hood, or somebody opens their door on your door and gets the door ding, I mean, it's costly. It costs them time, and those guys are just so valuable now that it's almost like not until Thursday will we see somebody make a full-on football tackle or block or run.
I want to get back to that and ask what the cost of that is, because I know the upside is the preservation of the players.
Sure.
I want to know if there's a downside to that, but here is Pete Carroll on Bobby Wagner's procedure.
He's had the procedure before. Okay. That's not his first time. So it's kind of a I don't even know how to the reason I'm not telling you what it is because I don't know what it is, okay? So I would tell you if I knew, but he's done it a couple times before. It's been successful for him, and it's helped him out over the years, so it just felt like it was time to do it, and so we took the time to go.
I like the idea that it's a mystery procedure.
Come on.
I love it.
Come on.
Yeah.
He's the head coach of the team, and he doesn't know what the procedure is.
He knows.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I guess it's no big deal. But Greg Bell from the News Tribune reporting that it's platelet-rich plasma therapy to his bulky leg. And Pete wouldn't even say, so I assume it's his knee, but who knows? Maybe it's his ankle or his hip or something else.
Does he have dead leg?
I don't know.
Remember, we had dead arm.
Dead arm was Flynn, right?
Yeah. Well, I can tell you one thing I did see in the 9-on-7 period, which is the run period, the very first play, Bobby shot through a gap and made a tackle for like a 4-yard loss. So he's fine. Bobby's fine.
Does it make you feel a little bit better to know it's platelet-rich plasma injection?
Is this the Regenikind thing all over again? Is that a different way of putting it?
I think Regenikind is different. I might be wrong about that, but I know that they're all kind of a similar blood spinning thing that goes on.
Well,
they take the blood, they spin it around really fast, the good stuff gets pulled out to the side, and then they eject a bunch of that good stuff back into the injured spot with the idea that the coagulated, concentrated good stuff, the platelet-rich part of the plasma, will help you heal.
I guess there's nothing to worry about, but still, you just signed this guy to a Mega Million contract, and so when you see something like this and your coach is vague about what it is, you kind of go, huh?
Yeah, but do you need Bobby Wagner to play on Thursday? I'll answer the question. No. No, you don't. Look what the Rams did last year. They didn't play any of their starters in the preseason. So it's just that part of it's starting to go away. I don't mind that because, look, I have not talked about Bobby or KJ or even Russell that much because you know what you're going to get from them. Dwayne Brown, Bradley McDougal. I mean, you know that those guys are going to – it's going to be excellent. So it's more about the other guys and how they fill in the sort of bottom end of their roster, you know, and that's what's really important.
Well, speaking of Bradley McDougal, we will interview him today at 5 o'clock. That's our Seahawks spotlight. We also have Mariner tickets to give away. Once, we're going to give away one pair every hour and from 3 to 6 today here on Danny, Dave, and Moore. This hour is brought to you by Parsons Extreme Golf. That's the preservation side of why you don't play guys in the preseason. There's nothing for them to really prove. You know what you're going to get from them. And there's certainly, I haven't covered the NFL that long, just since 2005, but there's been a huge flip in the way teams practice. And I think some of that is because Seattle's on the fairly extreme end in how much they limit contact, that they really don't practice. But I can remember vividly Bill Parcells talking about what a big change it was to not hit over the course of the regular season. that it used to be you had contact practices during the regular season that you weren't.
Every once in a while, yeah.
Yeah, pulling up. And now you don't even see them in training camp. You do not see tackling drills, full contact tackling drills in training camp.
Right. Yeah, I'm trying to think about the last year that in the league for me was Fire Marshal Bill, Mike Shanahan. And the thing we used to do is go out in full pads, and we would go through our individual drills, and then you would do 9-on-7, which is a run drill where there's no receivers, no passing, it's all run. We'd do that in full pads. Then you take your pads off, and everything else was done. So that was like the beginning of practicing smarter, you know, where you don't get guys hurt that much. So, I mean, and it's just gotten more and more and more that you don't have guys like, you know, Mike Iupati and DJ Fluker. Those guys do not need to be out there. I mean, they're already kind of on a pitch count just based on what you've seen for the last 2 or 3 years that, you know, those guys will miss a couple games a year. There's just no need for that. And those guys are pros. So it's a lot smarter. There's no question. But I do think that there is some value to, you know, as far as the running game, and if you're not a veteran of knowing how things are going to be different and how much faster it is than college and getting all the fits in the running game and everything like that, you know, and what I mean by that is like if you're going up and just kind of putting your hands on a guy and, you know, holding your gap and he's kind of doing the same thing to you. But when you get into a regular season game, it's a battle. You know, it's a bar fight for that gap. You're fighting for it. So it's just, you know, it's just different in how all the technique and everything that you use. But I think Pete, better than any coach, he practices smart. You know, the last thing you want to do is lose a guy like Bobby Wagner in the preseason. That'd be ridiculous.
What about tackling, Dave? I'm assuming it's just, you know, riding a bike. Everybody knows how to do that. You remember how to do it. But do we see more missed tackles as a result of that?
Well, I mean, did they miss a lot of tackles last year? I don't remember a lot. I mean, Tedrick Thompson had a little bit of a problem with that. But everybody's on the same page, right, as far as the NFL goes. And, you know, I think Pete does a good job of emphasizing tackles. I was watching the D-line group do a tackling drill which is really smart. They have a big padded mat, you know, and then those guys are running, and so nobody's landing on the ground. They're landing on a big padded mat, and they work more on technique. And just head placement and hand placement and everything like that. You could do that. You can do that without going full speed and knocking the tar out of somebody.
It is Danny David Moore. The one piece of injury news that I think will be significant, Ed Dixon, the tight end.
Yeah, that was a tough one.
They're talking about the possibility of a knee surgery, and he might be out 5 to 6 weeks. Before I heard that, I thought and really had looked and I think Ed Dixon might have a hard time making this team. Mm-hmm. I think that even before that, I think that Seattle and there had been a little bit of a buzz, like maybe New England was looking at him or kicking the tires, because he's certainly a serviceable pro. He's a guy that's a strong blocker, but the way that Will Dissly has come back, I think, has been faster than anybody really expected, and it certainly appears, well, hear from Pete Carroll on Will Dissly and Nick Vinette, because if those two guys are ahead of Ed Dixon on the depth chart, there's absolutely no doubt that Ed Dixon won't make the team, not with his veteran salary, but here was Pete on those two.
Just had a great day today. He was all over the place, and he's making a bid wanting to play this weekend, so we're watching and listening carefully because he looks like he's ready to go. He's had excellent work. Nick's been great, you know, the whole time for us, is just a solid guy that can do everything and has been really good around the red zone, and so we count on him. Russ loves to go to the tight end.
Are those your top two tight ends, Dissly and Vinette?
Right now, yeah. And, you know, I'm hearing good things about Vinette and the practice. And I was standing next to Jake Heaps, and, you know, Jake talks to Russell quite a bit. And there were some things, just certain games, where I saw Nick Vinette run really nice, crisp routes. He ended up catching a touchdown in the Ram game down in L.A. And I remember watching him in warm-ups going, wow, there's something different there. Just the crispness of the route, how sharp he ran it. Then he ends up catching a touchdown in that game. So, yeah, I think the way Pete described him is perfect. Like, he's a really good, solid blocker, a really good, solid receiver. I think Ed Dixon might be a better receiver, though. I really like his hands. I've always really liked Ed Dixon. And unfortunately, he's going to make a little bit over $4 million this year. And so if you can keep Dissly and Nick Vinette, and then, you know, Hollister looked good in that scrimmage the other day. He had a number of catches. They ran a whole bunch of sort of play-action pass type of stuff, and he had 4 catches in that scrimmage. So he looks good. He's probably not going to – so you got two extremes, right? Your tight end could be George Fant, and that's a run situation. Or it could be Jacob Hollister, where you can put him in there and maybe get a mismatch with a linebacker. So I think those guys might fit well together.
Yeah, this seems like it seals Ed Dixon's fate to me, and we've been talking about it. Even when Dixon was healthy, it seemed like he was on the bubble because of the salary cap implications. But and then with Hollister coming on and having the good game, as you mentioned, or the good scrimmage. So, yeah, and Disley, it's pretty remarkable what he's done. I know he's a younger guy, but I've always, you know, I've read the stories about patellar tendon injuries, Victor Cruz, other players that have had a hard time coming back. Jimmy Graham probably hasn't been the same player, whether that has to do with his injury or his age, maybe a little of both. But Disley having a good practice today and wanting to play on Thursday, and it's just it's pretty amazing how quickly he's come back from this.
I thought Jimmy Graham came back pretty well from the injury.
Yeah, I thought he was okay. Maybe I just don't
like Jimmy Graham.
I don't like Jimmy Graham. It's nothing personal. I mean,
he doesn't talk to reporters. You don't like that.
No,
part.
I don't really care that much. I appreciate that he's got a Vizsla. You know, he's got a dog owner. But I just didn't think that he was a good fit here in Seattle. Did anyone? I mean, no one did.
What if he didn't have a dog?
I still wouldn't have liked what he did. It just seemed I just hated how the Seahawks always try. Oh, they got to target Jimmy Graham more. They got to get to Jimmy Graham more, and his body language didn't look good. We've covered all that ground though. I'm just glad he's not here anymore, even though I have nothing against him.
We do have a very exciting opportunity to interview 2/3 of the broadcast team for Saturday's scrimmage from Popkeeney Stadium. Dave Wyman was on the play-by-play call. Jessamine McIntyre reporting live from the sidelines. First of all, Popkeeney, best high school football stadium in this part of the country in King County?
Definitely.
Best one I've been to.
It's a great spot.
Pretty awesome.
I still love downtown and the shadow of the Space Needle.
That place is a dump.
I know. I know it is. But
did you go to the ranch?
I did not go to the ranch. Somebody texted in because we were asking for good burgers the other day. What was that with Shaquille?
Yeah.
Yeah. Somebody said that it's run by teenagers now, and it's not the same.
The ranch is run
by
teenagers.
What's the matter with teenagers?
Yeah, they should be flipping burgers.
Yeah. So, I did not go to the ranch. But anyway, that place is awesome. It's so different now. I mean, they got Jason Myers had a couple of field goals that hit windows in the apartment buildings there. And whoever moves into those apartment buildings can have a great view because they're down in the end zone. So look right down on the field. But it was a great atmosphere. It really was. It was crowded there. It was very loud. They did a good job doing interviews before, and then Blue Thunder was there and cheerleaders, whole thing. I mean, it was really cool. And you could tell Pete really liked it. So it was a good sort of atmosphere to get them prepped for a preseason game.
Who stood out to you?
Jacob Hollister did. Look, I mean, this is boring, but it was Russell Wilson. Russell Wilson stood out. He is great with play action. And I think the offense is going to be so good this year with and Jake was next to me describing some of the plays, you know, some of the guys that they would leak out into the pattern that they hadn't in the past with play action. But Russell just looked really sharp, especially for a guy who just come from his grandpa's funeral all the way on the other side of the country. So that looked good. Our guy, Barkevious Mingo, looked good coming off the edge.
He's just a pass rusher now, right?
Yeah, he's not a linebacker anymore, apparently. So remember last year when we talked to him, he's like, this is my first time ever playing linebacker. So he's getting on the edge. On the other side was Cassius Marsh. So, and, you know, I think I've said
with
it. There's
short
only
shorts.
Yeah, he's got the short shorts.
Yeah.
But you
they're
don't like
hot
those.
Pants. No. Entirely
like
too short.
Yeah.
No.
So, but, you know, I would add Barkevious Mingo to the group of guys that kind of are quick twitch guys off the edge that can get you that, you know, that sack coming off the edge. So, yeah, he looked good. I was really happy to see that because he's a great special team player. But and also, in a pinch, he can play linebacker, but they're so deep at linebacker. That was the other disappointment. Cody Barton didn't play. But as Jess and I noted, he never stopped talking the entire scrimmage. He was next to somebody just constantly.
He was next
ear.
To Justin Curry and then also Ugo Amadi, and who also we learned is pretty talkative. And they were just pop, 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 pop. Yeah. It was not always a linebacker he was next to either. It was just constantly going.
Right, which is a good sign. I mean, look, he's engaged in practice and watching what everybody's doing. I'm assuming he was talking about football down there. But, yeah, that was a disappointment not to see him there. The Ed Dixon thing was very disappointing, too. But overall, I mean, it looked really good. It looked like they got some pass rush. I think KJ probably could have had a sack, you know, on one of the strip sacks that he had. He was rushing a little bit. So, and then Puna Ford really stood out. He did a really good job in the run game, the 9-on-7 drill that they ran. And then I guess he had some phantom 100-yard dash.
Yeah, what was the crazy play? The ball went off the crossbar?
Yeah, so it's out of bounds, right? When it hits the crossbar, and he caught it, and I guess just decided to take off running. So
how'd he look?
Good.
Move
for a big fella.
Shouldn't that be live? Like, if it goes off the crossbar, why do we make that a dead ball?
I think if it hits anywhere and bounces back on the field, it should be live.
Yeah.
How did it go off the crossbar?
It was thrown.
Oh, it was just thrown?
There's a bar there, and it hit the crossbar and then came backward.
Yeah. Well,
From time to time, you'll see football strike those.
Wait a minute. How often have you seen that happen at a game?
Hardly ever.
In a game? Barely ever.
Yeah. So that's why I was reading the story in the Times about it. I was going, well, how the heck did that happen?
Right.
Like, the Geno Smith or Paxton Lynch just uncork one in the back of the end zone?
They overthrew it, apparently.
Well, I think they put it where no one else could get it.
Yeah.
Right? So, yeah, and you got Jazz Ferguson jumping up there, grabbing it. Didn't have DK Metcalf, but, yeah, just trying to make a desperation play there.
Strained oblique for DJ Metcalf. Jessamine, what jumped out to you about the scrimmage?
I mean, what I like to see was, and I was saying this on the broadcast, was the rookie-to-veteran communication. Like, none of them, it wasn't like rookies staying with rookies. Obviously, Cody Barton was a good example, but J.D. McKissick was out. He was back today, by the way, so he's just fine, but he didn't participate in the scrimmage. He and DK Metcalf were just constantly talking, and DK was actually taking notes. He was charting every single play, so it wasn't like he was just sitting out. We still don't know what's hampering him, I don't believe so. But there was a – what's up?
Oh, no, I was going to say, Jess, that's a great way for – and I'm sure your dad probably did that for injured players to chart plays. Mm-hmm. I know my redshirt year at Stanford, I would sit there and write down the defense, write down the plays. I mean, it's a good way to stay engaged in practice.
Absolutely, and he was. He was very engaged. So that was something that I really noticed. Also, everybody got up. It really was like a game day atmosphere. I think Pop Keeney holds 4,000, and it was really raucous. The guys treated it seriously. I mean, it was a practice, but it was kind of cool to see so many new faces with such a roster turnover, with so many younger guys on it, really get up for that kind of thing. We used to talk about how, you know, I guess tenacious that some of those practices could be. Guys would get after them, after each other, and you don't see those guys there anymore. I mean, you're talking about your Michael Bennett, your Richard Shermans, and, you know, those guys who get really loud and rowdy, and there's no, you know, mean, mad alpha dog out there anymore. And there just seemed to be a little bit more bark to their bite on Saturday.
I just love that we just heard the word rowdy.
Rowdy.
Yeah, I haven't heard that one in a long time, Jess.
Fantastic. I'll bring it back again.
Yes, yeah. We're bringing Rowdy back.
On the one hand, I want to characterize the Seahawks training camp where they go to a high school stadium, a great high school stadium in Pop Keeney. Jason Myers is hammering field goal attempts off the windows of a still-being-constructed apartment complex. Everybody's music's playing. And then in Cleveland, Freddie Kitchens, and I saw this, that he declared today in a quote, "The days of inside information and the days of unnamed sources and stuff like that have ended. So you're not going to get that information like that, ever, anybody. And if I ever see it, they're fired immediately. That's the way we're running this organization."
Oh.
I got this question. How exactly is he going to fire the person who gave the unnamed the unnamed information? He's not named.
He's going to sniff him out.
He's going to waterboard him? Like, what exactly is this theory there on how to flush out the, we got some unnamed information here, and this is who, you just going to fire who you think did it? Because if that was the case, it'd probably be pretty easy if you were an assistant who didn't like another assistant to say something that sounded like him to a reporter and get him canned.
Well, no matter what stories are going to come out of Cleveland this year, because there's so much interest in what's going on with the Browns, so maybe we can expect some firings from Freddie Kitchens this year.
We will see. It is time for us to take two here on Danny, Dave, and Moore.
Take two! The Battle of the Jakes is underway at Montlake as Bush Hamden tells Larry Stone the competition is wide open at quarterback, most likely to one of the Jakes, either Easton or Hayner.
Shenanigans.
Yeah, no one believes
shenanigans. That. Shenanigans. Incorrect.
Whenever they say that, I mean, I think that they have a pretty good idea. Like, I would say 80-20. Like, I'll leave a 20% chance window open that if somebody just comes in and blows us away, then he's going to get the job.
And we have seen Hayner a little bit. And Hayner, if you'll remember, was the guy that they put in the Cal game because things weren't going anywhere and promptly threw a pick six that turned out to be the deciding play. So if we're really going to go with Jacob Hayner at the UW, yeah, this is shenanigans. Jacob Eason's going to be the starter. And they can say everything they want and probably try to keep it in the dark up until, but this is I'm not buying it.
Yeah, I'm with you on that one, Danny, but we'll see. I mean, Coach Peterson wanting to keep it under wraps, and Mike Leach does the same thing. We won't know if it's Gage Gubrud or who it's going to be starting for the Cougs in their first game. And
well, you know that players are reading the paper too, right? I mean, they're going to find out, so I don't blame them for doing that. Like I said, I think in their minds it's maybe 75-25, but, you know, they always want to leave a window open for somebody to, you know, just shine and just surprise them.
And I guess you got to transfer in Jacob Eason. You don't want to be making it seem like he was promised the job,
right,
to come here.
Well, Pete Carroll does the same thing. I mean, he does it at the professional level. I don't think that you're talking about Geno Smith overtaking Russell Wilson right now, but when Russell first came in, it was Matt Flynn's job. So, you know, he's always done that. I don't think it's just the college level.
Always compete.
That's what they say.
That's what Pete says.
Mariners got swept this weekend, but they have the day off today and welcome the Padres to town tomorrow.
They got no hit on Saturday. Second time they've been no hit, right? They managed to run yesterday. Kyle Seager's hot. Is that about sum it up?
Yeah.
Let's go to break.
Okay. Honestly.
What do? Do you just sit there and keep poking the dead body with a stick?
The guy that no-hit them. This is where I reach my breaking point. The guy who went six innings against the Mariners of no-hit ball. He was 0-13 in his last 17 decisions.
You got to tip your cap to him, Jim. He gets paid,
too. He was 0-13. And so he gets traded from Toronto to Houston, and then just magically overnight. He was.
I don't think it was magically overnight.
I know you're not supposed to care what's happening at the major league level, but damn it, I care about it anyway. It's bad baseball. It's tough to watch. And hey, but wait a minute. You know, they told us it was going to be this way in a complete rebuild. You got to expect. Well,
do you have rebuilder's remorse?
Oh my. Well, yeah, I do.
Yeah,
I do. Give me the hitting machine back.
That's you would
actually. Wait a minute. No, then J.P. Crawford wouldn't be out there, and that's one of the players you expect to be around. But I mean, some of these other guys, you know, like Marco. Do you look at him and go, "Yeah, that's a guy that I want in my rotation in 2021," I suppose. But not like he knocks your socks off when you watch him.
Would you rather them win 75 games and have Robinson Cano, Nelson Cruz, Gene Segura, and all that payroll?
I'm laughing because I don't know. I just hate watching what we're watching, though. It's just no fun at all. It's, you know, going on 18 years. I know we're getting ready to talk to Divish here. Maybe we can find out more about it. He can talk sense into me. But I don't care if it's the Houston Astros. But you watch that team, and you're telling me you're going to all of a sudden in 2021 catch that team? I don't think so.
Well, they're going to get really expensive, Jim. That's how it's going to happen. They're not going to be able to afford all their players. And sometimes the prospects they trade, say, to get Zach Greinke, they're not going to have a stock-to-farm system. Are you saying you're skeptical of this?
Very much so, Danny. I'm skeptical of most things.
It's Danny Davenport. We got Ryan Divish of the Seattle Times. He joins us next.
From the Alaska Airlines Studio,
it's Danny, Dave, and Moore, streaming everywhere at 710sports.com and the 710 Seattle app.
The weather, hot in Texas. Seattle's offense, not in Houston. Seven hits, three runs.
Seven hits.
No hit seven on Saturday
hits.
Night.
Wait, the seven up. Hits, which game?
I think it's total, right?
Wait, seven hits
in
three
games?
Games?
Ryan Divish joins us now
on the Zeke's
Pizza Hotline. I want to get the first question out of the way. Ryan, they got no hit the other night, Saturday night. The guy that no hit him through the first six innings, he was 0-13 his last 17 starts. Do I have that correct? How can something like that happen?
Well, he's pitching against the Mariners. That's how it could happen.
Hi, Ryan.
You know, he's really talented. You know, he won the ERA title, I think, 2016. He was an all-star. I think he won 17 games. There were some kind of issues going on in Toronto. I think, you know, he just had kind of gotten away from who he is. And he goes to the Astros, and they got that secret sauce or magic pitching dust they sprinkled on him. And all of a sudden, he starts throwing fastballs up in the zone, which he'd never really done before, and kind of following how they want to pitch to batters. And all of a sudden, he got really effective. I think the adrenaline of a new team, a packed stadium and all that stuff had some play into it. But, I mean, Aaron Sanchez isn't without talent. He was an all-star. He's better than any pitcher the Mariners have right now on their staff. So I wasn't surprised that he had success. I think I even wrote that might be the under-the-radar trade for the Astros that really puts them over the top, because if they fix him the way they fixed Gerrit Cole and Charlie Morton, then they've added another top-line starter
that they're not really paying very much money for. While, yeah, everybody makes a big deal about Zach Greinke, they've added another guy with a power arm that can do some stuff.
Ryan, what is the secret sauce the Astros are using? Because you mentioned a couple guys who have gone there and become way more effective than they were in their previous stops. What are they doing?
Perhaps it's the disgusting humidity of Houston that empowers them to have success, because, man, that place was miserable. No, I don't know exactly what it is. I do think it's mindset and how they attack hitters. They really believe in pitching up in the zone. I think that's important. They attack in different ways. The Mariners have tried to copy a lot of the stuff that the Astros do. They just don't have the talented arms to do it, maybe with as much success. But I do think that that's one of the big things, is that their belief in throwing the four-seam fastball more up in the zone helps. And I think also when you have that lineup behind you, you know you're going to get runs, and you have that kind of talent around you. I think that allows you as well to kind of go out and attack more and not maybe pitch to the edges or be kind of as fine or worry about contact, because you know that you're going to have run support every time you step on the field.
All right, Ryan, knowing that it's just disgustingly humid down there, and they had 7 hits in 3 games, and I know how sometimes, just sometimes, you tend to be grumpy, but because I was thinking about you this weekend, but what about, can you find any sort of light at the end of the tunnel as far as a player goes, somebody that that you think is playing well through all of this?
I'm writing about Seager for tomorrow. Over his last 12 games, he's hitting 340. Let's see here, 340 with about a 1.13 OPS. So, you know, he's hit the ball hard. He's done some work. Another 48 games left, so maybe he can kind of salvage what's been a lost season. I really think that, you know, he came into this season with a lot of optimism about this kind of reshaped body and how he wanted to do some stuff. And then he got hurt right away, didn't really have a spring training, and then had the surgery. And I think in typical Kyle fashion, he was anxious to come back and kind of help the team. And I think he came back a little too soon. He only played in 9 rehab games. I think he should have probably played in about 15 of them and taken an extra week and tried to build up a little bit more similar to spring training. But I understand why he didn't want to do that. And I think that he struggled coming out of the gate, and then he hurt his other hand, and then that was a problem. But I think now that he's healthy, we're kind of seeing maybe he can be a little bit more of a run producer and more of a factor. I don't know that he'll ever be the all-star level player that we saw 3 years ago, but he's around. I mean, you can't trade him. He has that poison pill clause in his contract. So I think it's beneficial for him to kind of come around and be something, and hopefully be kind of a relatively productive leader of a bunch of kids that are going to be coming up over the next few weeks and are going to be around next year, and maybe be like Freddie Freeman or some of those guys that help these guys adjust to life at the big league level and what it means to work and get better.
Hey, Ryan, if you had to rate the rebuild, how do you think it's going so far?
I mean, like, it's hard to rate it. I think it's really hard to rate, and I wrote this in the mailbag the other day, that because so many of these guys are prospects, and we don't know if they're going to be successful. And, you know, nothing in the Mariners' past is that the development from prospect to major league player has gone smoothly. In fact, it's been awful for a lot of players. And so it's like hard to kind of reach out and touch what this is. But I guess if you're like looking at it in terms of talent, yeah, I think it's probably about a B in terms of the talent they've acquired. You look at where they went from 30th in the prospect and the organizational prospect rankings to, well, I think they're 11th now on Baseball America. I think that's pretty significant. I think that, you know, those are kind of signs, but, you know, detracting from that is the struggles with Yusei Kikuchi this year. The injury issues with Mitch Haniger, Marco Gonzalez is up and down kind of season. Those are guys, Kikuchi, Mitch and Marco were all kind of older guys that they were expecting to kind of help bridge this gap and help these young guys, you know, when they're struggling, they're going to be the foundation guys. But Mitch has had a kind of a lost season with the injuries, and he wasn't great before that. And Marco's been up and down, and Kikuchi has really, really struggled to adapt to the MLB style. So in that regard, maybe you'll lower the grade a little bit. I think in terms of the talent they acquired, it's a B. But in the pieces that you're trying to build around, maybe that's down to a C or even a C-.
We're talking to Ryan Davis of the Seattle Times here. Ryan, of those three guys you mentioned, Marco, Mitch, and Yusei Kikuchi, which is the biggest long-term question for the Mariners?
Well, I mean, I think Kikuchi should be in some level because you've given him the most money. You know, you've committed at least 4 years of salary, I think about $57 million. And, you know, you had this expectation that he was going to be a front part of your, you know, the top part of your rotation, maybe not the number one, but at least your two or three. And right now he's pitching below a five. I think there's talent there. I think he's really struggled to kind of understand how difficult this game is. And, you know, I think he went from being a guy who had, like, atypical stuff for a lefty in Japan to being just another guy here. And it's how he reacts to it. I think he works really hard and is really kind of committed to getting better. So I'm sure there will be improvement. You know, if he was just a 26-year-old prospect, like similar to James Paxton, the starts and stops of James Paxton when he would get called up. But, you know, where he goes after the season will be much more determinant of his place, you know, how he reacts to the season and what he does next season than what he's done this season. Because I think it's just been such an adjustment. He's, you know, beyond the on-the-field stuff, he lost his dad. He's in a totally different culture. He's a father for the first time. He's got a lot of other stuff as well. So I think that's the thing. But, you know, Marco and Mitch, you're not really paying them anything. And you really won't be paying them a ton in terms of guaranteed dollars. The one thing with Mitch is, though, you want him to do something in this last month and then at least to start off strong next season, because you want to reestablish his value in the market. If you decide that maybe this step back isn't going to be as projected, maybe they have some setbacks with some players or something, you want him to be able to generate prospect value next year mid-season if you feel like this isn't going in the right direction and you want to add some more younger talent.
Divish, do we have any clear idea when we're going to see Haniger back?
I think he was hitting today. I saw some pictures of Safeco. It looked like he was hitting today. I'm guessing he'll go out on a rehab, and in typical Mitch fashion, he'll want to go out on a rehab in the next couple of days. But I think they'll do it next week. You know, I think we could see him by September 1st. Would be the best time. He should go out and play for a while. I was someone right, like when I was talking about with Seager, he played in like nine rehab games, and he should have played 15 at least. And I think Mitch has been out so long, and you really don't know how he reacts to that injury, that he should take his time to get back in terms of games, making sure he's ready so he can come back, and then you're not having to worry about his day-to-day health, whether you can play him every day or not. And then if he comes back in September, your rosters are expanded. So if he does, even if you can't, like, maybe play him 3 days in a row, you have enough bodies to offset it. You're not playing an infielder in the outfield all the time, which you've seen. It's just, it's getting kind of absurd. They need to make some decisions with some of these guys. I mean, playing Tim Beckham in left field is just not what they want. But with Jake Fraley going on the disabled or the injured list in Tacoma, I think that kind of nullifies that for a little bit.
Right. I'm a little more cynical than usual today, so bear with me. This controlling the zone philosophy the Mariners have, maybe it's going better than I think it is, or maybe it doesn't matter because most of these players that we're seeing this year won't factor in the 2020s, but where are we with this philosophy?
Yeah, it hasn't been great. I think you're right. Some of the players that are part of their future are good at it, like Vogelbach's pretty good at it. J.P. Crawford's really good at it. You know, I think those guys are guys that are important. I think Seager's trying to embrace it a little bit more. But, yeah, it's hard to say who they are right now. I mean, they're running out a team that is essentially, you know, mostly AAA and Quad A guys that you never expected. I mean, Ryan Cort is a nice story, but he was playing independent ball last year. They have three guys right now on their team, I think, that played independent ball at least last season or the start of this season, meaning no organization wanted them to go forward. That's significant. I mean, you look at their bullpen, there is no established guys. Once they got rid of Elias and Strickland, all you have is Anthony Bass, who was in AAA this year. I kind of was joking with somebody, but the starting lineup that they put out the other day against the Astros had five guys that spent time in AAA this year because of either poor production or that's where they were at or signed to minor league deals. Meanwhile, the Astros are rolling out George Springer, Altuve, you know, Alex Bregman. I think I wrote this, two games. Baseball is being played by two teams, but it only looked like real baseball from one team.
He is Ryan Divish, our little ray of sunshine. We're happy he's back from the humidity. The heat, not as bad as the humidity when it comes down to Houston. Ryan, thanks so much, man.
Yeah, no problem. Take it easy, guys.
All right, Ryan Davis to the Seattle Times. We do have two tickets after that rousing endorsement. Two tickets to the Mariners. Come join us on Friday. We're going to give those away next.
This is Danny Dave and Moore.
Live from the Alaska Airlines Studios at 710sports.com and the 710 Seattle Sports app.
This hour, Danny Dave and Moore is brought to you by Parsons Extreme Golf. Here's your chance to win a pair of tickets to this Friday's Mariners game. They host the Rays, who are on the receiving end of an entirely unnecessary tweet from the Miami Marlins. We'll get into that and sweeping the dial. Let's just say there's a general rule. Don't make fun of actual deaths, right? If you followed that rule, I think 90% of Twitter outrage would be absolutely nipped in the bud. Don't mock actual death.
Yeah, that goes without saying, I would think.
Don't mock an actual death. Anyway, we'll get to that at Sweeping the Dial. And don't forget to come by early. Stop by our live broadcast at Edgar's Cantina from 3 to 6. Tickets and our broadcast are brought to you by Greg's Japanese Auto. Our fourth caller at 206-421-3776.
No Mariner trivia?
No Mariner trivia. I'm worried that it might be too mean-spirited, honestly. I don't want to come up with questions or like, hey, can you tell me who, just name a pitcher, who had the 7 hits over the weekend? All of these things were ideas that came through my mind, and sometimes in an effort to be kind, gentle, and giving.
Well, that's good, Danny. That's nice of you. I couldn't name every Mariner bullpen guy right now, could you?
No, not right now. We have a number of guys that have cycled through. I've started to view the Mariners in part like a time capsule. They're going to be buried beneath the ground for a little while, and I'm not going to do my best not to think about them until, I don't know, maybe a year from now I'll check on them again, kind of see how things are going in there. Hey, you guys looking a little better?
Don't you open a time capsule like 50 or 100 years later?
Yeah, but it's baseball. I'm saying as opposed to checking in every night on them, like, oh, let's see what the Mariners are doing.
Well, you're still going to be watching them, though.
Yeah, I always watch
them. Padres are in town and the Rays. We can see how Mike Zunino's doing.
Yeah.
Last I checked, he was hitting 165.
Yeah, he's one of the guys that has not taken off. That's part of what makes the Mariners' struggles this season so weird, is that it's not like the guys that they traded went and tore it up elsewhere. Like, Paxton's been okay with the Yankees. He's been hurt a couple times.
I bet you if you're a Yankee fan, you're disappointed in James Paxton.
Zunino, who was the biggest chip in that trade for Malik Smith. Malik Smith hasn't been great, but Zunino's been worse than he was here. You haven't had deals. The deal with the Mets. Like, Robinson Cano has had a bad year. Edwin Diaz has not been nearly as... There's not one trade that you look at and say, man, the Mariners gave up a guy who was just a rocket ship when he got to his new team.
Isn't it weird, though, to see Nelson Cruz? And he missed two or three weeks, and he still has 30 home runs or something like that. He had 3-1 game over the weekend. And you sit there and you go, well, boy, it'd sure be fun to watch Nelson Cruz back at T-Mobile Park. But at 39, you can see why they let him go, too.
You know, that would be cruel if Mike Zunino came here and hit one out of the ballpark. We always speculated that he would actually hit one out of the building.
He's got the ability to do it. He and Judge in that one game almost did it. Both are in the, was it the same series? I know Zunino got into one last year that was two rows down. Judge clobbered one. Maybe that was 2 years ago that he did that. Just absolutely obliterated it. Veterans on the brink. I think that's something we can start doing for the Seahawks training camp, because I think that you've got now two veterans that I would say they're playing for their spot on this roster. And the two guys that I would say, Ed Dixon and Barkevious Mingo. I think both of those guys, as it stands right now, they're in the on that roster bubble of competing for spots. Barkevious Mingo moving from linebacker to defensive end. I don't think he's ahead of Cassius Marsh on the pecking order at that position. You've also got Jacob Martin that fills in there and projects pretty highly as a player with potential. I wonder if Barkevious Mingo is going to end up making this team. And I say that because a year ago, they decided they didn't want him to rush the passer, that he would play a more conventional linebacker spot. Now they're having him go back to rushing the passer, which is what he did before. So in some ways, this feels like, hey, man, you've got to take off with this role if you're going to make this team.
Yeah, I don't know if I see it that way, though, because you have so many good stand-up linebackers that maybe it's good to move him back down. I'll say this. If last year at this point, if he was that much on the brink and you said, oh, they're moving him to linebacker, he's done. There's no way he can do that. And he did it. he handled it. So I feel like he's handled it. Those two guys, I agree with you, but I think Mingo is definitely pointing up, and unfortunately Ed Dixon is headed down a little bit as far as where they're headed right now. It's too bad with the injury. I just remember talking to Pete last year about Ed Dixon and, you know, saying, well, what do you think about him? He's like, we haven't seen him. Just haven't seen him. And I don't know. That was an NFI, right?
Mm-hmm.
Non-football injury that he showed up with. So that can mean that they didn't know about it or they weren't a part of it. And I think that wasn't super popular. The games when he came back, played in 10 games, he did well. I mean, it didn't throw him the ball a lot. Again, I think it was 13 targets and 12 catches, and he had two or three touchdowns. So it's too bad. I really like Ed Dixon. But now if you look at his salary, and also I think it matters that Nick Vinette has really stepped up. But if you – certainly you didn't, but if you had asked me which one of those two, I'd say Mingo definitely has a much better chance. What about you guys? I mean, it doesn't
I'm with you. I'm with you on that. I think Dixon's on his way out, especially with the news today.
It's too bad.
Knee surgery and probably out 4 to 5 weeks, so that doesn't help his case. And Danny's talked about the salary cap and what you save if you get rid of Ed Dixon. The same with Barkevious Mingo. You save $4.1 million if he's released. But I think Mingo's on his way up. I like what he did at that scrimmage, and he told Bob Condotta of the Seattle Times that he came into the league to rush the passer. He's getting his opportunity, and he's such a factor on special teams, too, that I think he ends up making the team.
It is Danny David Moore. We'll bring in the professor, add him to this conversation next.